MacCast, Sunday, December 10th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to have you back here with me. It is December. I know, we're getting close to that holiday season. I hope you're having a nice month so far. I'm starting to see snow pictures from all over the world, so we know winter is here with us. But we have a great show lined up for you today. We got lots of things to talk about. We're going to be getting into Apple Watch bands and something interesting happening there. Going to be talking about Apple possibly developing some new chips, some stuff they haven't developed before, maybe some more affordable iPads in the future. Unfortunately, another week of more bugs that we need to discuss and let you know about, and also some big news on the Apple TV front. We got lots of actually a lot of Apple TV news this time around, and then a little update on Jony Ive, everyone's favorite Apple designer, a little change in what he's doing over at Apple that I think you're actually going to be pretty happy about. So we have all that. Then we're going to get to your feedback. I've got some feedback on application launchers on iOS. We're going to talk about Apple Pay Cash and some tips and tricks there. Talk about Apple security and how that's managed in iOS in light of all of the recent issues. And some Apple Watch stuff along with a cool little Easter egg and a thing of the moment. We haven't done a thing of the moment in a while, so I wanted to get one in this episode. Maybe we should do one every day in December, or every episode in September or December. Man, I'm having trouble today. Just so we can get you in ready for the holiday season. I'm going to maybe give you some of my favorite products and software and things like that, so you can round out your holiday wish list. So we'll get to all of that in just a moment. But before we do, I want to get started by thanking one of my show sponsors, actually a new sponsor here on the MacCast, and I'm so excited to have these guys on board, Small Dog Electronics. If you've been around in the Mac or Apple communities for a while, you probably know Small Dog. They've been around since 1995 when they started actually shipping products out to Apple fans and customers from their living room. Yeah, small startup business grown to a big business, do a lot of online sales, but also have retail stores. And they have an amazing selection of everything you might need for your Mac and Apple needs, new and refurbished products and accessories. They recently expanded their selection of home automation stuff. So if you're getting into that, especially if you want HomeKit products, they have a great selection of that. So check out their items there. They also have a refurbished and clearance section that you should check out, because you can probably save some money on some great Macs. And I talked to them and they mentioned that one of the things they've been expanding recently is their dented box item. So in this case, you get a brand new item at a great price, but it just might not have the prettiest box in the world. And that means more savings for you, great deals, and you get some great products. And what I love about Small Dog and what's awesome about having them around is it isn't just some big conglomerate warehouse company that you're dealing with. These are real people and real dogs, actually. You can go to their website and check out the dogs of Small Dog Electronics, but you can look them right up on their website. You can find out who works there. You can even get their phone numbers if you want to call them up, and they are great people. You're going to get great personal service, the kind that you would expect from a friend in the Mac community. And that's really what Small Dog is. So that's what's so exciting about having them here. And like I said, they're local, they're regional. They have two locations in Vermont and one in Florida. So if you happen to be in any of those areas, stop by their location, say hi, check out their stuff, and tell them you heard about them on the MacCast. They would love to hear that, I'm sure. And just some other great things with going with Small Dog. One, no sales tax on most orders. You get free shipping on orders over $75. And also, your products will ship out the same day on orders made before 3 p.m. Eastern time. And it doesn't stop there, because of course they're going to give the MacCast a deal, or MacCast listeners a deal. That means a deal for you. You can use the coupon code MacCast at checkout, and you will get $20 off an order of $100 or more. So you're going to save some money, and you're going to be dealing with a great company, big fans and supporters of the Apple and Mac community. Again, since 1995, these guys are awesome, so you really should check them out. Smalldog.com is the website, and be sure to use the code MacCast to get $20 off an order of $100 or more. And a big thank you to Smalldog for their support of the show. Let's talk about watch bands. An Apple watch band gets FDA approval. And no, this one's not from Apple, though. Tim Cook has publicly said several times that actually Apple wants to avoid adding features to the Apple Watch that would cause them to go through FDA approval. And the reason for that is it would slow down Apple's ability to rapidly develop new Apple Watch features. So they don't want to slow that down. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the health features in the Apple Watch can't be really good. As a matter of fact, a recent study, for example, found that Apple Watch could detect sleep apnea with about a 90% accuracy rate and hypertension with an 82% accuracy. But it's going to limit what Apple can say about those features and also what they can do related to health stuff, right? They can't make certain claims without FDA approval. So even though the Apple Watch can now detect an abnormal heart rate and those sorts of issues, abnormal heart rhythm, it can only alert you about the issue, but it can't provide any specific diagnosis. And that's why a company called AliveCor jumped in and developed something called the CardioBand EKG reader. And after about 2 years of going through the process, you can see how this could slow Apple down if they were doing this, they got FDA approval. And what this band does is it gives an accurate EKG reading by just touching a sensor on the band for about 30 seconds. And because it now has FDA approval, it can actually diagnose if you're having atrial fibrillation and notify your doctor and provide a readout information to him or her. So that's pretty amazing. And it uses just a CR1620 battery in the band that they say will last for 90 hours of operation time, which the company says typically means it'll last about 2 years in typical use. Now, the band costs $199 US and does require a $99 a year service on top of that. But if you need something like that, if you need that kind of accuracy and monitoring, it's great that you now have that option. And that's one of the cool things I think about the Apple Watch is Apple designed the bands to be so interchangeable that it can not only be for stylistic reasons, but also really cool health reasons like this, where you might want a different style band. And I fully expect that we'll see more bands and options like this, specifically in areas related to the health field, coming out. So it was kind of cool to see this one this week. Now, somewhat related, or I guess not really related, but on a similar topic, Apple launched its own heart rate study app this past week in partnership with Stanford Medicine. And this is something you can opt into if you're in the US. The Apple Heart Study app is available for download now, and you can download it and opt in to share your data on irregular heart rhythms with the researchers at Stanford Medicine. So what will happen is if the app detects that you're having an irregular heart rhythm, you're going to get an alert on your phone and your Apple Watch, and you will be offered a free consultation with a study doctor and an electrocardiogram patch to do further monitoring. Now, to qualify, you do need to be at least 22 years old to participate, and you have to own an Apple Watch Series 1 or later. So this will not work with the original Series 0. But again, I think this is part of Apple's whole research kit project, which is all about trying to get more data into a lot of these studies. So if you'd like to participate in that, again, if you're in the US and at least 22 years old, you can download the Apple Heart Study app now. And then one other thing related to Apple Watch now qualifies for a refund in Apple's recycling program. In the past, they would just take your old Apple Watch and recycle it for you, but they didn't really offer you any cash like they do with iPhones and iPads and other products. Now, through their recycling partner Brightstar, you can actually get a gift card valued between $50 and $175, depending upon the model of Apple Watch that you're trading in. For older Apple Watches, that's as long as they're in good working order. And what you'll end up getting is a gift card that you can use towards the purchase of devices from the Apple Store, either at their retail locations or online. So if you have an old Apple Watch you're thinking about upgrading, that is now an option for you, which is pretty cool. We know by now that Apple is pretty fond of designing its own chips, everything from wireless chips like the W1 all the way up to, through, and including GPUs and CPUs like their A-series processors. Well, this week we got a report from Nikkei claiming that Apple is working on developing now its own power management chips in-house. Currently, the power management chips are designed by a UK company called Dialog. This week's report brings back memories, I think, of another UK chip company. You may remember Imagination Technologies. They had a GPU technology called PowerVR that Apple had licensed for using in their A-series chip designs, and Apple informed them earlier this year that Apple was going to be going with their own designs in their latest chips, and therefore we're no longer going to need to license from Imagination Technologies the PowerVR designs. And that caused a huge to-do, big lawsuits, and ultimately ended up with Imagination Technologies actually closing down, unfortunately. So they were very reliant on Apple's business and their licensing to actually keep going with PowerVR. They had a big stake of the company sort of invested in that. Well, Apple reportedly accounts for almost nearly three quarters of Dialog Semiconductor's revenue. At least they did in 2016. So I'm a little bit worried we may see a repeat if Apple does end up going with their own power management chips. Hopefully Dialog has enough warning at this point to kind of figure that out. Now, if Apple does move on to its own power management designs, it's possible that they may not even need to pay royalties to Dialog, which again would be another big blow. It's not really clear, though, if that would be the case at this point. Just depends on how Apple does their designs. But the piece from Nikkei also claims that as soon as this year, Apple could be moving to their own chips. That's not a firm date, but they think we could see them in 2018. Other analysts have predicted that in 2019, Apple would move to their own power management integrated circuits. So they have reportedly been hiring a number of Dialog engineers. And I personally wouldn't rule out a future buyout either. I mean, it could be that Apple just jumps in, buys the company, and that would be an easy way to solve any potential IP issues and also bring a lot of talent in-house into Apple's own teams. And we've seen them do that before with other companies. So I think that would be the way to go. We'll have to wait and see if that happens. But if Apple does move forward with this plan, it's predicted that their partner for manufacturing would be Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, and they would handle doing the actual chip manufacturing based on Apple's designs. And of course, Apple wants to bring power management design in-house so they can get a better handle on bringing more battery life and power management to their devices. So it just makes sense. You know, Apple kind of wants to control everything. They want to be able to tightly integrate their hardware and software, and this would just be another step toward that, and they can really optimize things and get more power out of our devices using the battery technologies that we have. And that's ultimately, I think, a really good thing for us, especially as Apple goes into developing smaller and smaller devices and things like the Apple Watch. So a lot of people really want multi-day battery life out of their Apple Watch, and if Apple's going to be able to do that, a step towards making that happen might be just them designing their own power management chips. So pretty exciting to think about, and we'll have to wait to see what they come out with. I'm actually curious, is it going to be like the P1 chip for Power One? They seem to like that naming convention, so we'll have to wait and see if we get that in a future keynote. What do you think about a more affordable iPad maybe coming in 2018? There was a report from DigiTimes that claims that Apple is thinking about releasing an updated iPad at an even lower cost than the current 9.7-inch iPad. The current entry-level model is priced around $329 US, but this report claims that they could come out with a version priced at, get this, $259 US. I think that's a great starting price point. And they believe the updated model could be released in the second quarter of 2018, so we might not have to wait too long to see this updated iPad. As a matter of fact, Apple has recently seen an uptick in iPad unit sales growth. If you remember their numbers from the last quarterly results call, that was after several quarters of decline. The latest numbers were up 15% year over year, with Apple selling 11.4 million iPads. It probably helped a lot that they had the updated 10.5-inch iPad Pro, and also this reduced cost 9.7-inch iPad. Apple had lowered that price, if you remember, lowered down to that price back in March of 2017. So it's likely that Apple could be considering another price drop to kind of keep the good sales trend going for iPad. Unfortunately, the piece doesn't really go into what, if any, improvements Apple would have planned for the updated model. I wouldn't expect much outside that lower price point. I guess there is a possibility they could give it a small processor bump, maybe bringing it up to an A10 Fusion chip. It'd also be nice to see them upgrade the storage from 32 gigabytes up to maybe 64, but I'm guessing that's not likely at that price point. And they're going to have to do a lot to keep the price that low. But I think if they can get the price down to $260 US, they're going to sell a lot of those models, especially maybe into education and schools, also for other kinds of maybe enterprise applications and things like that. It's a great model. Even with the pros out there on the market, there's a lot of fans of the 9.7-inch iPad. So that could be good. Another thing to mention about moving into 2018 with Apple products is AirPods. Ming-Chi Kuo says AirPods are going to stay very popular in 2018. As a matter of fact, he thinks that shipments could double to between 26 to 28 million units for the year. So Apple selling a lot of AirPods already, but maybe selling more in 2018. And I have to tell you, I absolutely love my AirPods, one of the best Apple products that I've ever bought. And I've heard very similar things from many of you. They just work great. They work as advertised. Battery life is great. I have them in my ears every day, both for phone calls, listening to music, and also listening to podcasts and watching movies when I'm sitting down to relax at the end of a long day. So absolutely love them, and I can't say enough good things about them. So if you're looking for a holiday gift, I did a presentation for my user group that was a holiday gift guide, and I would say AirPods for any Apple fan are tops on their list. So whether you want them for yourself or want to give them as a gift to an Apple fan in your life, I think they're going to be very happy to receive those. And stock seems to be all right now. I know Apple was off to a rough start, but pretty much now I think you can walk into an Apple store and find a set of AirPods relatively easily. And I think the shipping times aren't too far out. So I wouldn't delay or anything if you're trying to get them as a holiday gift, but go ahead and order them. And I think anybody would love to receive that. Unfortunately, another week has gone by and it has brought some more Apple bugs. Back on December 2nd, there was that nasty date bug in iOS 11.1.2 that might have hit some of you. What was going on was after midnight on that day, if you had applications that used local notifications, time-based local notifications, you could wind up in this situation where your iOS device would either continuously crash or relaunch the springboard, the app screen, over and over again. Now, Apple quickly rushed out the 11.2 update on a Friday, which I immediately thought was weird and didn't really realize why they were doing it till the next day when I started to receive reports of this issue. But it appeared to have the fix If you were already being hit by the bug, you actually had to go in to settings, notifications, and then you had to go into all of your apps and turn off the allow notifications option. It was like a big hassle. Then you had to update your device to 11.2, and then after updating it, you'd have to go back in and turn on all your notifications again. So it created quite a hassle for a lot of people. Now, the fix seemed to be in some of the beta releases that were leading up to the release of 11.2, but what was weird was it seemed like Apple last minute rushed this release out on an off day. It was expected that 11.2 was going to come out the next week. So it seemed off schedule, but it also made it seem like Apple already knew about this bug. So that has raised a lot of questions among the Apple community and among the Apple press, myself included, as to what is going on. Why is Apple kind of seemingly making all of these weird mistakes with bugs and things like that? Another thing that bothered me about how this was released was that it just caused a lot of confusion for a lot of people, myself included, specifically related to Apple Pay Cash. We'll talk about that in a minute. I want to talk about a few of the other things that were in the 11.2 update in case you missed them. The update also did bring 7.5 watt fast inductive charging support for iPhone 8. 8 Plus and iPhone 10 models, so you can now get a little bit faster charging. I know some devices offer charging up to 10 watts, but Apple now has support for 7.5. And like I said, the release notes also mentioned that Apple Pay Cash support was enabled by the update. And the reason that this was confusing was that while it was in the support for it was in the 11.2 update, Apple was not scheduled to actually activate the service until the next week. So I got the update on Friday, and prominently in the release notes, it said, oh, Apple Pay Cash. I went to try and figure out how to turn it on that Friday, and I couldn't figure out how to do it. I actually had to ask a bunch of people and then was told, oh, yeah, they're not activating the service till next week. So it was just really confusing. Again, kind of a bad rollout of 11.2, in my opinion. But Apple Pay Cash did actually go live on Monday or Tuesday. There was a weird rollout on Monday. Again, many people, myself included, saw the option for Apple Pay Cash first thing Monday morning, and then when you would try to enable it, you'd actually get a failure message, and then suddenly later in the day, the option was completely pulled away from a number of people. Now, I know some people did get activated on Monday, so I'm not sure if Apple turned it on and then because it was being overwhelmed, they were having server issues and then they decided to turn it off, or who knows? It was just, again, another bad rollout from Apple. But then by Tuesday, it all seemed to be working again and no problem. You could sign up for Apple Pay Cash. And we'll talk about a little later in the show how to activate it, how it works, and all that sort of stuff. But then after all that happened, just this weekend, 9to5 Mac reported on a pretty serious HomeKit flaw that was demonstrated to them that allowed for unauthorized remote access of HomeKit devices, including things like your smart locks and your garage doors. So there's a vulnerability that could allow, if you have those HomeKit devices, allow someone to remotely access that. The issue impacts the current version of iOS 11.2. And luckily, Apple has already been made aware of the bug. They've implemented some server-side changes that prevent access to this bug. And they are already working on a software fix. So they're going to plan an update. Apple said in a statement that the temporary fix, quote, disables remote access to shared users, which will be restored in a software update early next week. So expect another iOS update next week. Now, 9to5 Mac, to their credit, did not explain exactly how the hack was accomplished. They only noted that it was, quote unquote, hard to reproduce. So this wasn't an easy bug to get in and exploit, but still a very serious bug. And it was good to see Apple taking swift action once again, but it does leave a little bit of egg on their face because they've talked about how important security of HomeKit is. And here was a vulnerability that seems to have been introduced, I think, by the 11.2 update. It may have been there before. Actually, the 9 to 5 Mac piece claimed that Apple was informed about this vulnerability and related vulnerabilities to HomeKit back in late October, but only some and not all of the issues were fixed as part of the 11.2 and the watchOS 4.2 updates. So I guess this wasn't just part of the 11.2 update. Some patches for various HomeKit-related vulnerabilities were in 11.2, but I guess not the specific one. So probably that's what prompted this person who demonstrated it to 9 to 5 Mac to come forward. And it does seem after they came forward and after 9 to 5 Mac reported it, that Apple jumped on it and did something on the server side to shut down this exploit. So good on 9 to 5 Mac for reporting this. But, you know, again, just another area where it kind of questions, why is Apple releasing so much buggy software as of late and stuff that has pretty serious vulnerabilities in it? Now, Apple has come out after the root exploit that we've talked about on the show and said publicly that they are going to be reviewing their policies and how they handle QA for stuff like this and how they handle the security things. So hopefully that means they're going to be more on top of it for the future. But still, again, not a great couple of weeks for Apple, at least with respect to bugs in their operating system. There was one pretty big announcement of a new product at the Worldwide Developer Conference that a lot of us have been waiting on, have been anticipating, that finally released this week. And I know it's unfortunately not the new iMac Pro, but I think a lot of you are going to be very excited when I tell you, if you don't know already, that the Amazon Prime Video app has finally arrived for the Apple TV. You can grab it from the App Store now. And the good news is it does have full integration for Apple's TV app and does support Up Next. So Amazon needs to be applauded for actually integrating it well with Apple technology and the Apple TV, at least at that level. We're going to talk about a little problem with the app, or a little complaint, I guess, some people that have about the app a little bit later. But it does have also support for HDR and 4K video, but oddly, a number of people are reporting that it doesn't seem to support 5.1 audio. Now, this could be a bug. There's many reports that showed up on Reddit after the app came out and a few other sources that said they were only getting 2.1 audio. It would be very strange to have 4K video HDR support and then not support what is considered to be the very basic version of surround sound, which is 5.1. Now, Amazon support did say on their Twitter that the Apple TV app does support 5.1 audio, but many users are reporting otherwise. So they're looking into it. Supposedly, if it is a problem, that will get corrected. And there's also updated iOS apps, Amazon Prime apps, not only for the Apple TV, but also for your iOS devices. So you can get full support for the TV app and Up Next on your iPhone and your iPad as well, along with access to Amazon Prime Video. Now, the audio thing may be related, and I'm just speculating here, may be related to the discovery that the app seems to be kind of this trumped up port of Amazon's HTML5 smart TV app for Prime Video, the same thing that they put on, you know, every TV set that's out there that has Amazon Prime Video built in. And that's caused a number of people to wonder if Apple somehow gave Amazon a special entitlement to use web views inside their app, because Apple TV apps typically can't have just a web view or a web browser that presents information inside of them. Now, that doesn't seem to be the case, at least by some comments made by a number of people who've been looking into this, including developer Steven Troughton Smith. He seems to think that one of the reasons the app took so long to get here, you know, many of us were wondering, where is the Amazon Prime app? Are they going to get it out before the end of the year? One reason it may have taken so long is because it looks like Amazon had to develop a whole new custom, what Troughton Smith calls UI glue layer for tvOS. So they had to basically not use native controls because they weren't writing a native app. they had to kind of shoehorn in and build this UI layer because they could not use web views. So the whole thing seems to be kind of janky. And the reason I think this may be related to the audio bug, the 2.1 audio bug, is they wouldn't have access to the native app audio libraries either, I don't believe. So, you know, they're having to kind of write everything from scratch. And it seems like it's way harder to do this than to just build a separate version that is a native app. Now, I think from Amazon's perspective, they're thinking, well, we can use the same core code base, and then we only have to do some minor things. And yeah, we'll have to build it up front, and it'll be really hard at first. But once we have the libraries, that'll be better moving forward. But I think what they often think about or forget about is the fact that it's going to be harder to add and support new tvOS native features in the future too. So as Apple adds new features native to, you know, to the native apps, they're not going to get the benefit of that. They're going to have to somehow find hackarounds or ways to tap into that. So it just seems like kind of a mess. But again, the good news is that the Prime app fully integrates with the TV app, Apple's TV apps. And that's been the way I've been exclusively accessing now my Prime Video content on my Apple TV. I love the TV app. It makes it easy to find and search for stuff. I get great recommendations. If I'm watching a series or something like that, I can pick right up where I left off. I can go in and add things to my up next, so I can kind of bookmark stuff regardless of the source, other than, of course, Netflix. I really wish Netflix would get on the ball and add Apple TV app support along with Up Next support, but I doubt they're ever going to do that, unfortunately. But, you know, it's great to have the Amazon Prime app on there. A lot of people, myself included, are Amazon Prime members. And the other good news is Amazon Prime Video app rolled out to 100 countries. So it's available almost anywhere. If you have Amazon Prime, grab the app, and I'd love to know what you think. Let me know if you're enjoying it, if you're liking it. Shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. So some other entertainment and Apple TV related stuff. tvOS 11.2 came out for the Apple TV 4th Gen and the Apple TV 4K. The big deal here is it now added support for the automatically switching of HDR and frame rate settings on the Apple TV 4K. What you can do is you can go into settings, video and audio, match content, and there are now separate toggles for both dynamic range and frame rate matching. So you can choose one or the other or both, and then depending upon your input content, it is going to try and match the dynamic range and the frame rate, something that a lot of people were asking for. And we talked about on the MacCast as a deficiency of the Apple TV 4K, but Apple has moved beyond that. The update also does add support for live sports. So if you have an ESPN subscription or a link through your cable service, you can now activate that. It also works with a number of the other sports apps. So if you're into sports, you now have a tab specifically dedicated for that. And some unrelated but really good news is that over the weekend, it appears the Apple TV app is starting to show up outside the U.S. for some 4th Gen and 4K Apple TV owners. Those of you in the U.K., France, and Germany, you want to check, you might have Apple's TV app available to you now. And I know I'd heard from many of you, specifically in the U.K., asking, hey, when are we going to get Apple's TV app? Well, you should have it now, and it is amazing. I can tell you it's gonna change, I think, how you interact with your Apple TV. I was telling somebody else, I now use that little TV button on my Siri remote, because I'll go find something in the TV app, go to watch it, and the way it typically works is it'll find it regardless of which app it's on, but then when you play the content, it will automatically jump over to that app. So let's just use the example of Amazon Prime. So if I found something on Amazon Prime through the Apple TV app, I press play, it launches the Amazon Prime app and just starts playing the content right from there. But then when you're done, you're still in the Amazon Prime app. So you could either continue to browse for something else on Amazon Prime, but typically what I'll do is hit the TV app on my Siri remote, jump back automatically to Apple's TV app, and then I can find something else And I can find it maybe on HBO now, or I can find it on CW, wherever, it doesn't really matter, or back on Amazon Prime, and I can just play it right from there. And I absolutely love it. It is awesome. Again, a couple of other Apple TV and entertainment-related stories. Apple reportedly has purchased a podcast search engine developer, a company called Pop-Up Archive. Oddly, I had never heard of this company before, but they had a website called AudioSeer.ch, Audio Search, AudioSeer.ch. But that website was reportedly shut down on November 28th. The site, when it was up, offered a full-text search of podcasts along with search recommendation API, and they gave different shows what they called a buzz score, which was based on both the iTunes charts and iTunes reviews of that podcast. So they sort of ranked podcasts with this little ratings system. As far as the acquisition goes, Apple gave their standard statement when they were asked about it, quote unquote, Apple buys smaller technology companies from time to time. We generally do not discuss our purpose or plans. So they haven't said what they plan to do with it. The hope, of course, is that Apple is going to roll the technology into iTunes and into the podcast app to make improvements, probably specifically in terms of doing recommendations, but also full text search of audio would be awesome as well. If you could do that inside the podcast app and find stuff, that would be really, really cool. So hopefully they roll this technology in and roll it in pretty soon, and we see some improvements to the podcast app. I've heard from a lot of you saying you really hate the new design, you hate the app, it doesn't work for you very well. I'm starting to feel the same way. I do use Apple's podcast app, but you know, the reality is there's a lot of really great third-party apps out there. Castro, Downcast, Pocket Casts, all great options for listening to podcasts. I know a lot of people really like Overcast. So if you're not happy with Apple's offering, there are some great alternatives out there, and I encourage you to check some of those out. But we'll have to see what Apple does with this pop-up search archive company and their technology. And then also kind of related to audio, there's rumors that Apple might be looking to acquire the company Shazam. This is coming out of a report from TechCrunch. The service, if you're not familiar with it, is the one that allows you to identify any song, TV show, film, or advertisement within seconds by letting it listen to a little audio clip. And actually, Shazam is integrated into Siri. So if you ask Siri, what is this song? And you can just, you know, hold it out and she can listen to the audio. She can identify it using Shazam in the background. Now, the piece over at TechCrunch claims that a deal has been in the works and is getting really close to being done. As a matter of fact, they say we could get an announcement as soon as Monday, December 11th. So there may already be an announcement that Apple has acquired Shazam by the time you hear this podcast. The deal is estimated to be at a value of around $400 million. And as far as what Apple plans to do with Shazam and the technology, I would imagine it would be integrated somehow into iTunes or Apple Music. Maybe they would expand some of the functionality inside Siri. I was thinking initially that maybe it could be for the HomePod, but considering that the HomePod is a speaker itself and it's actually playing the audio, I don't know how it could listen back to itself or why it wouldn't already know the metadata. So I guess maybe if there's third-party apps, but we don't have that with the HomePod, at least not initially. So it could get integrated and worked into also maybe some of Apple's augmented reality technologies, but who really knows? At this point, we're going to have to wait and see if actually Apple makes an announcement that they've acquired Shazam. And then finally in the news for this week, Jony Ive is going to return full-time as Apple's chief development officer. Now, he never really left, but Bloomberg is reporting and Apple has confirmed that Jony Ive will once again take over direct management of the hardware and software teams. Now, you may remember that Ive became Apple's CDO back in 2015, but recently he had stepped back from heading both the hardware and software design teams, and that was so that he could focus on the development and design going on inside and around Apple Park, Apple's new campus. Now, you may also remember back at that time, there were these rumors that Ive might be getting ready to move into retirement, that he was considering leaving Apple, maybe going back to the UK. But a lot of us, myself included, never put much stock in those rumors. Now, some people still thought that maybe this was the direction. You know, he was sort of phasing himself out. And at the time, Apple put forward two new vice presidents to handle UI design and industrial design. That was Alan Dye and Richard Howarth. They were both added to Apple's leadership page, Dye in charge of the UI and Howarth heading up the industrial design. But now they've both been removed from that leadership page. They're assumed to still be at the company. That hasn't changed, but it's unsure how their roles might have changed now that Johnny Ive has stepped back in to head up both the hardware and software design teams. But a lot of people very excited to know that Ive is back focusing on design. I'm trying to think if we really saw anything different with him not being there. The team seems to have done a pretty good job. They pushed out the whole new redesigned app store and music app, which I think are great. They tried to apply that same design to the podcast app, where it maybe doesn't work quite as well, but at least it's consistent. And the new look and feel of iOS 11, I'm sure I've had a little bit of a hand in that, but it was kind of headed up by a couple other guys. And I don't know about like the HomePod, again, when we're looking at things like the hardware design, you know, was that Richard Howarth or was that more of Ive's influence? Was that already going? So we don't really know which designers worked on which projects or which people headed up which projects. But again, nice to see Ive back in charge of all that stuff and not retiring from Apple and not going away. He is probably even taking on a bigger role at the company, or at least stepping back into a bigger role at the company than he has had for the last few years. So with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Squarespace. Look, if you need a website, if you want to put something up to promote your business, maybe promote yourself through your art portfolio, maybe you're trying to get a job, maybe you just want to put together something for your club or your favorite group, your sports team, Squarespace makes it super quick and easy to get something incredibly awesome up and running, possibly in minutes, and they just handle everything for you. One of the things I love about Squarespace is it's one single source that you can go to. You get your domain, you get your hosting, you get professional quality design, great looking websites, access to all kinds of great high-end features like e-commerce, social media integration, all your analytics, everything all in one place on this great platform with some of the best customer support in the business. They have award-winning 24/7 customer support. So when you need help, you can get it, but you're probably not going to need it because they make things so incredibly easy. I have developed a few websites for the MacCast to promote different events and things like that through Squarespace. And I did it because I needed something fast. I needed something that looked great. I'm a web developer. I could have built it myself from the ground up, but why do that when you have Squarespace? They're perfect for this kind of thing, and they have these awesome templates that are put together by great designers, and they cover just about every need you could possibly have. Portfolio sites, if you're a designer or an artist or a photographer, if you need a blog, they have great blogging and writing templates. Maybe you want something for an event that you're planning or a wedding. They're great for wedding websites. And also, like I said, your sports team, if you're a coach and you want to have a great looking website for your sports team, you can do that there too, or just to organize your club or your group. Maybe your user group needs a new website. Why build that thing from scratch? Just go right to Squarespace and you can have a great looking site up in minutes, and they have great little add-ons like blocks for things like maps or galleries, social media integration. You want to put audio on there. Maybe you want to do a podcast. You can do that. You can throw your audio in there, have an audio player right there on your Squarespace website. And you can also fully customize it. So if you want to do advanced things, you can get in there, you can put in your own code, You can mess with the styles, all of that sort of stuff. You have complete control, so you can take it from, you know, super simple all the way to complex. They give you everything you absolutely need, and it's just awesome. You really should check out Squarespace. Check out Squarespace. You're going to get a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, you can use the offer code MACCAST, M-A-C-C-A-S-T, to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace.com. Big thank you to them for their support of the MACCAST. So back on the November 19th show, I mentioned an issue in iOS 11 where they changed how you use Spotlight to launch apps. The complaint was that if you had an app and it was not part of Siri suggestions, then what would happen is when you tried to use Spotlight as an app launcher, under iOS 10, you could start typing the first few letters in the name of the app and it would pop up and you could launch it. No problem. With iOS 11, if it was not part of Siri suggestions, the app would not come up if you only typed the first few letters of the app's name. You actually had to type out the full app name before it would pop up. And you could fix this by going into Settings, Siri, and Search, and then you could tap on the app and you could make sure that you turned on Search and Siri suggestions for that app. But that's a little frustrating, because what if you really don't want Search suggestions or Siri suggestions for that app? You can't have one or the other. You're kind of stuck with both, and if you want it to be able to show up and launch that app, you have to turn that on. And that fix was fine, but it might not work for everyone. And so it was great that Douglas wrote in with a possible alternative. And I've known about a couple of these apps. I've never tried any of them personally, so it was great to have a recommendation from someone in our community. So thanks, Douglas, for writing in. But what he recommended was a third-party app from Cromulent Labs called Launcher. And I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. It is free, although you're probably going to want to pick up the $2.99 in-app purchase for the pro version that kind of unlocks all the features. $3 for this app seems like a really good price to me. Basically, what it does is it gives you a widget, or actually multiple widgets if you're on the pro version, where you can set up groupings of applications to actually launch from a widget in the Notification Center. So you just pull down Notification Center, swipe to the right to access your widgets, and then you have a launcher there. And you can set up different groupings of apps, which I kind of like, right? You can have different categories. Maybe you want all your photography apps together and all your browsing and communication apps together, maybe all your social media apps together, and you can just launch them right there from the widget. And Douglas does note that it might not work with all of your applications out of the box, and if you run across one of those, you can actually contact the developer and ask him to add it, although he did say he has not found a single app that wasn't supported by the app. But I guess it's not universal. Every app's going to be supported out of the box. It also will allow you to do actions, so you can not just launch an app, but you can launch an app and also have it do a couple other tasks. So that's pretty cool. And I do know that there's another app out there, Launch Center Pro, that's pretty popular. But I do think that's more focused on launching actions in apps and not just specific apps themselves. Although I could be wrong. I looked on the website and it wasn't really clear. But Launch Center Pro I know is very popular, but it seems like Launcher from Cromulent Labs will actually let you just launch apps as well. So two different applications to check out, and a big thank you to Douglas for giving me that follow-up. As I mentioned earlier, Apple Pay Cash is now out and available if you want to do person-to-person payments, at least in the U.S. I know it's going to be rolling out to other countries. It's U.S. only right now, unfortunately, but I thought we should go into some details on how to activate it, how to make it work, and things like that. So there's a couple of requirements that you need to have before you can get access to Apple Pay Cash. First, you need to be running iOS 11.2 or watchOS 4.2. You also must have two-factor authentication enabled on your iCloud account. So if you have those two things and you're in the US, then you should be able to turn on access and use Apple Pay Cash. Some interesting notes about Apple Pay Cash. Apple Pay Cash transactions appear to be handled through the Discover Network payment network. So what you get is a virtual Apple Pay Cash card that will show up in your wallet. And you can use that anywhere that you can use Apple Pay Cash. You can also, of course, use that to do person-to-person transfers of payments. If you are using it as at an Apple Pay terminal and you're somehow asked for a PIN or a PIN number is required, it's probably good to know that the PIN number by default is 0000 and you cannot change that. I know, a little bit of irony, because we're always told we should have a good secure PIN or password. Of course, this is Apple Pay, so you're going to either have Face ID or Touch ID protecting you. So I guess it's okay that you have this kind of generic PIN and everybody's PIN is exactly the same. So 0000 if you need a PIN. Payments, if you're using a credit card, will incur a 3% transaction fee. So you probably want to tie your Apple Pay Cash to a debit card. And after you hit send, you're actually given the option to select which card you want to use for sending if you don't want to use your default card. So if you don't have an Apple Pay Cash balance, what it's going to do is it's going to go directly off whatever card you pick for sending that cash. So to enable Apple Pay Cash, it's pretty straightforward. You can do it in three different ways. Of course, you have to have Apple Pay turned on and you do need to have some cards registered with Apple Pay. But once you've done that, you can either go into the wallet app and tap the Apple Pay Cash card and then hit continue to activate your Apple Pay Cash card. You can go into messages, and I think the first time after running the update and when Apple Pay Cash became available, it would actually prompt you if you wanted to open up the Apple Pay Cash app and activate it. Otherwise, you can just manually open the app from the messages apps, and then it will prompt you to turn on Apple Pay Cash. Or finally, you can do it from settings, wallet, and Apple Pay, and there's a little toggle button to turn Apple Pay Cash on. And when you turn that on, it'll just walk you through the process of activating Apple Pay Cash. Now, if you want to put funds onto your Apple Pay Cash card, you just tap on the wallet, tap on Apple Pay Cash card, and then tap the little eye icon down in the lower right-hand corner, and then you can tap on add money, set the amount, and then tap add, and then it will ask you to select a payment source. Again, remember that if you're using credit cards, you're going to incur a transaction fee, so you probably want to use a debit card, and you cannot currently add funds directly from your bank account. It actually has to be through a registered Apple Pay debit or credit card. Now, the reverse, luckily, is not true. If you want to transfer Apple Pay Cash funds back into your bank account, you can do that directly. And the way you do that, again, is tap on the wallet application, tap on your Apple Pay Cash card, tap the little info icon, and then tap transfer to bank. And if you don't have it set up already, it's going to prompt you to add your bank account information. That would be your bank account number and routing number. You're going to need to put in those two things. Then once you've done that, you can transfer money directly from your card to your bank account. If you want to use Apple Pay Cash as a payment method at an Apple Pay terminal, it works just like any one of your other credit cards or debit cards. You just select that as your payment choice and away you go. Again, it'll either pull directly from the funds that are on your Apple Pay Cash card, or it will pull through from whatever card you have attached to your Apple Pay Cash card. And then, of course, the big thing that a lot of people are going to use Apple Pay Cash for is sending money to a friend or maybe your favorite podcaster. Wink, wink. To do that, what you can do is you can open up messages. You can select or start a new message with the person that you want to send Apple Pay Cash to. Then you tap on the apps. You choose the Apple Pay Cash app. You set the amount you want, or you can also request funds. So if you want to ask somebody to send you money through Apple Pay Cash, you can do that. Then you tap the, you put in the amount and you tap pay. And then you will get a message. You can review the message. You can see the amount, and then you can tap send to send it. And that's it. It'll automatically go off. And then the person receiving it, if they already have Apple Pay Cash set up, it'll go automatically onto their Apple Pay Cash card. Otherwise, they're going to have to set up Apple Pay Cash and then accept the funds. And all happens kind of automatically. Now, you can go into the settings and require a manual action to actually receive funds. I'm not sure how that's different. I'm assuming you're going to get a pop-up notification saying someone's trying to send you money, and then you would actually have to accept it. But I think it's easier just to have it automated, and it looks like having it automatically accepted is the default. So when you receive Apple Pay Cash, you're going to get that. You can view the transaction in the message. You can kind of see what was sent, how much was sent, and that's about it. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. It works great. If you need to send money to someone, I think it's a really great way to go. So I'd be curious, you know, how many of you have had a chance to try out Apple Pay and use it, and what do you think about it? Apple Pay Cash, rather. Shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. In light of all the latest security issues we seem to be having with OS updates recently, specifically the latest root bug, I thought it was probably a good idea or good timing to have a little discussion about how Apple manages security, specifically on your Mac. If you've updated to Mac OS 10.13.1, so Mac OS High Sierra 10.13.1, after applying the security patch that came out a couple weeks ago for Mac OS 10.13.0, just be aware you may have to reapply your security patch. You're going to want to check and make sure that you're all patched up. If you don't see the security patch in Software Update, you can go to Apple's website directly and download it from there, or you can just install the Mac OS 10.13.2 update, which came out recently. That should get you all patched up and protected against that root bug. But, you know, some people might have noticed that the patch that Apple pushed out was automatically downloaded in the background onto their system. And you might be going, I didn't know that was something that was possible. And if it happened to you, you probably got a notification to install the update immediately. And the reason all of that stuff works is a technology built into Mac OS called Gatekeeper. And you may have heard that name before. Specifically, we've talked about it, I think, in the past as it relates to installing apps either from the App Store or signed developer apps that you download, and also unsigned apps. So the Gatekeeper, you can set it in a number of different ways. The default is to allow you to only install apps that have been signed with a developer certificate, meaning the developer has to be in Apple's developer program, or apps downloaded directly from the Mac App Store. And that's kind of the default. So you have it set up so you can do both those things. You can also make it more restrictive and say, no, I only want to allow installing apps from the Mac App Store. Or you can go less restrictive and say, nope, let me install apps from anywhere. I don't care if they're signed or not. And that is pretty risky to do. So I wouldn't recommend doing that. But that's Gatekeeper. Well, Gatekeeper also has a couple other features that are a little less known that I thought would be worth talking about. One of these is the ability for Apple to push out these critical security updates and have them automatically, not only automatically downloaded, but even installed on your system. So if this patch had been downloaded and you didn't immediately upgrade to it, you may have noticed that it said it would be automatically installed on all systems running the latest version of Mac OS High Sierra. So had you done nothing, it eventually would have installed itself to keep you patched and protected. And this happens by design. It's something you cannot opt out of. It is part of Gatekeeper, and it's all related to Apple's security. Now, Apple obviously only uses this functionality in the most critical situations, which in this case, it really was. This was a critical bug. They used it also back in December of 2014. So it shows you how infrequently they've used this. Back then, they pushed out a critical update that impacted security related to the network time protocol, to NTP. And so they pushed that out to everybody and made sure that that got installed. So, you know, I think ultimately this is a pretty good thing for us to have on our systems, Apple's ability to reach in and kind of protect us from some of the nastiest bugs that might sneak out there. Now, another feature of Gatekeeper is that it maintains a list of known malware and Trojan apps that are out there and prevents those from being able to be run or installed on our Macs. And Apple can push out updates to that list of known malware and Trojans in the background without us having to do anything either. So that's a good thing as well. Now, like I said, there are some settings that you can adjust related to Gatekeeper and software updates. So if you go into System Preferences, into the App Store Preferences, you can check the option to download new updates in the background. You can also check options for installing app updates, installing OS X updates, also installing system data files and security updates. That's one I would recommend that you leave checked on. And then also automatically downloading apps purchased on other Macs. So if you mess with these at all, I would just leave the install system data files and security updates one checked, because that's the one that's the kind of critical one that's going to keep you protected. Now, there's some additional protections that you can check out and look at that are not related specifically to Gatekeeper, but just some things that, in light of, again, the kind of security issues we've been having recently with these updates, you might want to check out. So if you go into System Preferences, Security and Privacy, File Vault Encryption on your device. I know there's a little bit of kind of debate about this. I think since Apple went to File Vault 2, File Vault is actually a pretty good technology. And what File Vault is its whole disk encryption for your Mac. And that means if your laptop gets lost or stolen, the hard drive is encrypted. So once your Mac is asleep or locked, everything is encrypted and safe. So if someone even pulls the hard drive out of your machine or just has physical access to your machine, your data is going to remain secure and protected. And I use File Vault on my MacBook Pro. I have used it for a number of years now. I've never had any issues with it or any problems. Again, I know there are people that sometimes do have issues and are not fans of File Vault, but for me and a number of people I know, it works great. So that's just an added layer of security that you can opt into that's part of the Mac operating system. And you just turn it on, it runs in the background, it does its thing. I don't see any performance hit from it. I don't see any other problems. So just something to think about. Also in Security and Preferences, you do have a firewall. Personally, the way I use that firewall is when I'm at home, I don't have it turned on because I'm at my home router and I'm behind some other security and protections that I have set up. But when I'm out and about, especially if I'm on public Wi-Fi, I'll try to remember to go into System Preferences, Security and Privacy, and enable the firewall. And that's just going to protect you from incoming connections that might be happening on that network. And then also in Security and Privacy, there are password settings. So you can make it so that when your Mac goes to sleep, that it requires a password to wake back up. And that is, I feel, something that you probably should have turned on. I have it turned on my system specifically because I'm using File Vault. And I want to make sure that when I walk away or my Mac goes to sleep, that those security protections are in place. But it's just generally a good idea. You don't want someone to be able to get into your machine when you've walked away from it or it has gone to sleep or something like that. So I would play around and just double check and look at those settings and see what the options there are. Another place to kind of check on your security is in the sharing preferences. So system preferences, sharing, go through and make sure that the things that are checked in there are things that you really want checked. Specifically, I would look at things like remote access or screen and file sharing settings, but also just any of the other sharing settings that are in there. I have a few of those checked on at home, specifically things like screen sharing. And those are things that when I leave my house, when I'm on public Wi-Fi or I'm going on vacation, I want to make sure that I turn off. Because if you're on a public network and you have screen and file sharing on, anybody on that network is going to be able to see those things. Now, you may have additional protections in terms of, you know, you have to have a user account. But if those things are turned on, it makes somebody else on that network aware of you. And also, if they're a hacker, they may want to start probing and see if they can't get in and do some things on your system. So you probably want to turn those things off. And a similar thing, you know, not quite as nefarious, but just something to think about is, are you sharing your music on iTunes? And another thing that I'll point out is that may seem benign, but a lot of times the sharing can reveal other bits of data or information, maybe your name. If you haven't changed the network name on your Mac, very often it uses your username or your login name, and it'll say, for example, Adam's MacBook Pro as the default name. Well, now someone, if I have sharing turned on or iTunes sharing, they might see Adam's MacBook Pro on the network, and they now know at least my name, and that can be another bit of information they might use to perpetrate any kind of hacks or attacks that they might be trying to do. So just something that you want to be aware of, and maybe consider changing it to something more generic. And that's another kind of layer of protection that you can give yourself. And then finally, in just related to the Mac operating system, you may have heard about System Integrity Protection, or SIP. We've talked about that on the show a few times. It's built into the Mac operating system, and it stops apps from being able to access, install, or manipulate items in places that could alter or impact the operating system. Basically, it protects critical layers of the operating system from being able to have stuff installed in there. And some people or some tutorials will sometimes tell you to disable System Integrity Protection. And this happens at a very low level. A lot of apps that maybe need to access low level parts of the operating system will tell you you have to do this. It's generally not recommended that you turn off System Integrity Protection. And if you do that to install something, absolutely make sure that you re-enable it if you've disabled it. You do not want to run your operating system with System Integrity Protection turned off. My general rule is I don't turn it off for anybody or for any reason, but I know there are some exceptions out there, and if you know what you're doing and you're careful about it, it can be okay, but in general, for most people, I would not recommend turning that off. So there you go. Just a few other gatekeeper and security related things that I thought were worth bringing up on the show and talking about a little bit. This is going to be like one of those I never thought it would happen to me letters, although a lot less risque. Okay, so don't worry, we're not getting into that area. But since Apple started adding security features to Siri and to their devices, things like SOS, where we can press a button on our Apple Watch and automatically call emergency services, you've probably heard, and I've heard, a number of stories about how an Apple device, an iPhone with GPS or an Apple Watch, actually saved someone's life. And this time, guess what? We now know someone who benefited from having an Apple product in a really significant way. It actually help them get emergency services. I got an email and a link to some news coverage, and I'll put a link to the same news coverage in the show notes at mattcast.com from a listener, Brian. He began working as a truck driver back in May, and unfortunately, a couple weeks ago, he was driving down the highway, and a car crossed over the yellow line and came head-on into his lane. Now, he tried moving over to the shoulder to get out of the way to avoid this car, but a guardrail first forced his truck down an embankment, and he crashed. And unfortunately, his leg was trapped. The entire driver cab side was completely crushed. Again, there's images in the article, and it's pretty bad. It's amazing that he survived and came out as well as he did. But his iPhone, everything that was in the cab was lost. There was nowhere to be found. But luckily, Brian remembered that he had been wearing his AirPods, and he used Siri and his AirPods to actually be able to call 911, and they were able to get to him and be aware of the accident more quickly and get there. Now, the news report incorrectly implies that it was his Apple Watch that helped him. It was not his Apple Watch. It was actually his AirPods. And I'm bringing that up because I would say this is definitive proof that AirPods do not fall out that easily. You're in a major accident with your AirPods in a semi-truck, and they don't fall out of your ears. I think that's proof that this is not a problem or a concern. So if that was something you're concerned about with AirPods, this is proof. Now, luckily, all involved in this accident, the driver, even the driver of the other car, survived. There were injuries, unfortunately, but it's good to know that everyone was okay. But just amazing news coverage, and just another example. And now, you know, kind of more direct to our community. There's a more connection to our community of someone who actually benefited and was saved by, well, maybe not saved, but helped by having Apple technology with them when they were in a serious accident. So, Brian, I'm really glad you're okay, and thank you for sharing your story with us. That's pretty cool. Here's a cool little thing, too, if you have the Apple Store app installed on your device. Not the App Store app. I want to be really clear about this because there's some confusion. But the Apple Store app, there's a cool little holiday Easter egg in the latest update to the Apple Store app. So this is the one that you would use if you want to, like, make a Genius Bar appointment, or you want to buy something for pickup at the Apple Store. So the Apple Store app, just open that app up. Tap on the little search icon in the upper right-hand corner and type the words, "Let it snow." And the minute that you type all of those, you're going to get a nice little holiday surprise of some falling snowflakes in the app. And you can even shake your device a little bit to give it a little bit of a snow flurry as it floats around in there. And it will stay persistent as long as you don't fully quit the app in the background. So if you leave it running in the background, every time you open up the app, you're going to have snow in there. If that really bothers you after trying it out, just fully quit the app in the background and all of that will go away. But nice little holiday touch that Apple hid inside the Apple Store app, and something that you can check out. And then finally for today, I do have a thing of the moment for you, a cool little solitaire game from the creator of Really Bad Chess and Sage Solitaire. You may or may not be familiar with those applications. Those, I guess, will be bonus picks for you because they're both really great apps. But this is an application called Flip Flop Solitaire. It's a variant of solitaire where you only have 5 piles. And you can stack your cards both down and up in terms of their sequence. So if you're familiar with solitaire and how to play, you know what I'm talking about. But basically, you could go 7-6-5-6-7-8. So you can go down or up when you're placing your cards. And you can only move suited stacks. So if you want to move a stack from one pile to another, they need to be all the same suit, like spades. So even if you're going up and down, those don't have to be matching suits, but If you have a run or a sequence, so say that 6, 7, 8 was all spades, I could grab that 6 and take the whole pile and move it on to another stack. And when you first launch the game and you're trying to learn the rules, what it does is it has you start out with a deck that only has one suit. So there's kind of, you know, special decks that don't really exist in reality. So you start out with an all spade deck and all 52 cards are spades. And then there's also the ability to move to two suited, three suited, four suited decks as you get more advanced and you learn the game a little bit better. But it's a great little solitaire app. The design is beautiful. It's clean and simple. It looks awesome. And it's free to try. And just $2.99 to unlock the full version of the game. And I'll just tell you right now, I tried one game and I immediately unlocked the full version because I wanted to have full access to everything. And $2.99, great price for this little solitaire game. Flip Flop Solitaire, flipflopsolitaire.com is the website. You can find it on the App Store. And it is my thing of the moment for this week in December. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. So you can get more information and details on all of their great applications by going to smilesoftware.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. And if you yourself would like to become a supporter of the MacCast, we've recently launched a Patreon campaign. If you have the ability to give a couple bucks a month, I would certainly appreciate it. You can check out our campaign and all of the rewards and things that we're doing by going to patreon.com/MacCast. A number of you have already become supporters, and I really, really appreciate that. I will tell you, Patreon made some changes recently to how they're doing their fees, and that does impact some of our Patreon supporters. I posted my thoughts and comments on a Patreon-only post, so head to patreon.com to read about the changes and what I think about it and that sort of thing. But we're going to be sticking with Patreon for a while. I think it's going to be okay. We might have to change up some things that we're doing over there, but overall, I think I'll be able to give you the options that you want and allow you to support the show in the ways that you want to support the show. So please, if you can give on Patreon, I would really appreciate it. If not, there are a number of other ways you can support the show. If you can give us a review or just some star ratings in the iTunes store, the podcast app, that is a great way to go, great way to support the show. Also, just follow me on social media. If you can follow me on my Twitter account, twitter.com/MacCast, I would really appreciate it. But thanks to everybody who supports the show, however you support it, and just listening, you support the show. So thank you for that as well. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you're always welcome to send me emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail, that phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you'd like to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.